This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
Another mess for the Secret Service. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Wednesday, December 23. Glad you're on board. Here's what we have for you this hour.
An agent with President Obama's security detail has some explaining to do. Reports say his handgun, badge, and a flash drive were stolen in the middle of the day from his car.
New information about the San Bernardino terrorists. During the vetting process, hear how they answered certain questions about their backgrounds.
In sports, the NFL has backed away from funding a study on brain injuries. We'll explain what's happening.
And money moves to make when you're in your 60s.
So, yes, it's natural. You should become a little bit more conservative and move towards protecting what you have. But don't forget that lifespans are growing. People are living longer, and retirement is longer these days. So you don't necessarily want to sell everything you have and move to cash.
Janelle Marte at The Washington Post writes about personal finance. Guidance for your 60s later in the hour. The Army soldier facing charges of desertion and misbehavior for walking off his base in Afghanistan 6 years ago has deferred entering a plea. During arraignment yesterday at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl confirmed that he understood his options. If he's convicted of misbehavior before the enemy, he could face a life sentence, while the desertion charge carries a maximum 5-year sentence. Colonel Daniel King is spokesman for the U.S. Army Forces Command.
The judge also inquired if Sergeant Bergdahl wished to enter any motions or a plea at this time. Sergeant Bergdahl deferred all of these decisions to a later hearing.
Mr. Bergdahl, a native of Idaho, allegedly deserted his unit at a combat outpost in June 2009 and was then held captive by the Taliban in Afghanistan for 5 years. In order to negotiate his release, you'll recall the Obama administration bypassed Congress and released 5 senior Taliban leaders in exchange for Mr. Bergdahl, who says he walked off his base in order to bring attention to, quote, leadership issues that he felt were putting his unit in danger. His next hearing is scheduled for January 12th. Well, we're learning more about the 6 service members killed in Afghanistan by a suicide bomber earlier this week. They were all from the Air Force. Major Adriana Vorderbruggen, a 36-year-old from Minnesota, was the first openly gay American female officer killed in combat, mother to a young son. Also, 31-year-old Staff Sergeant Louis Boncasa, a Bonacasa of Corum, New York. His parents told NBC News he had envisioned a military life since his teens. Leaves behind a 5-year-old daughter. The victims also included Air National Guardsman Joseph Lem, a 15-year veteran of the New York Police Department, and father of 2. Chester McBride of Statesboro, Georgia, was a star football player at his high school who joined the Air Force after graduating from Savannah State University. 30-year-old Staff Sergeant Peter Taub of Philadelphia was also among those killed, father of a little boy, expecting a second child next summer. 28-year-old Staff Sergeant Michael Cinco of Mercedes, Texas, was also killed. He was from Joint Base San Antonio Randolph in Texas. They were part of a convoy on a routine security detail Monday outside Bagram Airfield when a man drove up on a motorcycle and detonated a suicide vest. Changing gears now, when the SpaceX rocket launched and landed at Cape Canaveral in Florida this week, it was more than just an engineering feat. It may have been a real door opener. More from this morning's Dave Duncan.
The LA Times says the landing of the Falcon 9 made deep space travel seem attainable again, not just to aerospace engineers and astronauts, but to the masses. Analysts called it a giant step toward a day when rockets are reused like airliners. In turn, the Times says that would transform not just the global space industry, but perhaps even where we live in the future. Elon Musk, owner of SpaceX, ultimately wants to colonize Mars, according to one space industry analyst who says if you begin launching every other day, then the Mars vision doesn't seem so outlandish. Gordon?
Thank you, Dave. 11 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. By the way, if you like small business or entrepreneurial stories or are looking for some inspiration, check out The Small Business Report, done twice weekly and available on our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com or on places like iTunes and SoundCloud. Coming up next, American Muslims trying to find a political voice. Thanks for spending time with us on this Wednesday. In the wake of Republican frontrunner Donald Trump's proposal 2 weeks ago to ban all non-U.S. Muslims from temporarily entering the country, politicians from both parties, as well as members of the Muslim American community, have spoken out against the inflammatory rhetoric. But James Arkin at Real Clear Politics says lacking any nationwide organization to truly fight back, Muslim leaders are searching for a way to amplify their political voice. James, who are the groups trying to get this going?
Well, so you have groups like the Muslim Public Affairs Council or the Council for American Islamic Relations, or the American Arab Institute. These are some of the groups that I spoke with for my story. And they're all, you know, they're very small, they're niche groups. They serve the Muslim community and they serve particular interests, but they don't have sort of the broad, overarching, nationwide sort of political group that, say, the Jewish community has with the American-Israeli Public Affairs Council, AIPAC, or something like that. And so it's one of the people that I spoke with said there are these small groups, but in terms of lobbying government, in terms of engaging the media, they're just nowhere near what other communities have.
So do they have a specific strategy to change that and, say, find a singular voice?
So their strategy as 2016 approaches is essentially threefold. And this is something that they announced in Virginia over the weekend. There was a meeting of over 100 Muslim leaders from different groups, organizations, and mosques talking about this. And essentially, they announced a threefold strategy. The first is that they hope to register 1 million new Muslim voters and to really kind of get the Muslim American community to buy into their own, you know, involvement in this race, to get them to really use their vote, which is their political voice. So registering new voters, and then an effort to reach out to young Muslims with a sort of anti-radicalization education effort to kind of push back against some of the propaganda and that you see coming from terrorist groups like ISIS to try to prevent any sort of radicalization. And the third is reaching out and engaging non-Muslim communities through something that they're going to call an Open Mosque Day, inviting people who are non-Muslims to come in and to learn about the religion. So their goal is to engage their own community, but also to try and teach people who aren't Muslim and don't know much about the religion a little bit more about it, hoping that that gets some engagement and gets some conversation going.
We're speaking with James Arkin, congressional correspondent at Real Clear Politics. He's got a piece entitled Amid Hostility, U.S. Muslims Seek Political Voice. How much of part of the problem is criticism that, say, there's always seems to be a lack of a full-throated condemnation from the Muslim community when there's a terrorist attack?
So I think that part of the problem that these Muslim leaders that I spoke with see is that they feel like there is a full-throated condemnation, but they just don't have the voice, they don't have the power to really get that condemnation out there from their own religious leaders. And, you know, they speak out against what they see as inflammatory and hateful speech, but their voices aren't really heard nationwide the way the voices of Republican presidential candidates are. And they think that, you know, within, say, the Democratic Party, there has been consistent response against these inflammatory remarks that have been coming in recent weeks and recent months, it's not, as you say, as full-throated. It's not an overwhelming response to that. And so that's part of what they want, is they want to amplify their own voice because they feel like they are responding and just aren't necessarily being heard.
Is there a possibility, though, that there's not unified condemnation of, say, a terrorist attack because not everybody believes that those attacks should be condemned?
Obviously, these leaders don't speak for the entirety of the Muslim community, and I didn't reach out very broadly to the entirety of the community nationwide. I can't speak to something like that. I can say that everyone that I spoke to for this story universally condemned the attacks and say that they, you know, one of the points that they want to make is, A, that when ISIS attacks, often the people who are suffering are Muslims. And second, the point that they want to make is that when these attacks happen on American soil, they are in as much danger as any other Americans.
You mentioned, too, the two members of the House who are Muslim, Congressman Andre Carson from Indiana and then from Minnesota, Keith Ellison. Is there a lot of pressure on those two guys?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's one of the things that there is a lot of pressure on them as sort of these almost national spokesmen for the Muslim faith, because they're the two highest elected officials who are Muslim. But, you know, it's something that Ellison talked about a little bit in response to. He's been really out there. He's been condemning Donald Trump's remarks. The two of them have. They've been pushing back on this a lot. But also a message that they send is, well, they are not representatives for the entire Muslim faith. They are representatives for their district.
Thanks, James. James Arkin at Real Clear Politics. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
Gordon, according to Amnesty International, at least 200 civilians have been killed in Russian airstrikes in Syria. The human rights group accuses Russia of using cluster munitions and unguided bombs on civilian areas and says such attacks could constitute war crimes. Moscow insists it's targeting only the positions of terrorist groups. Military officials say a streak of light seen burning across the sky by people in three western states last evening was debris from a Russian rocket re-entering the atmosphere. Ed Krupp, director of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles, says most of the rocket likely burned up well before hitting the ground.
As it passes through the atmosphere, heats up, superheats the air. And so what people see in the sky is really a column of superheated air produced by this very small object.
The fireball was seen over Arizona, Nevada, and California last night. The Oregon woman accused of intentionally running over dozens of pedestrians on the Las Vegas Strip with her young daughter in the car makes her first court appearance today. 24-year-old Lakeisha Holloway is charged with felony murder, hit and run, and child abuse. Sunday's crash killed one person and injured at least 35 people. Holloway's attorney has acknowledged that her mental health could be an issue. A man from the Bahamas who allegedly hacked into celebrities' email accounts to steal unreleased movie and TV scripts boasted to an undercover agent that he had dossiers on at least 130 accounts of stars in entertainment, sports, and media. Alonzo Knowles is being held without bail after a court appearance yesterday on criminal copyright infringement and ID theft charges. And here's a weird story about a skull. Actor Nicolas Cage has agreed to turn over a rare stolen dinosaur skull he bought for $276,000 to authorities so it can be returned to the Mongolian government. The actor is not accused of wrongdoing, and authorities say he voluntarily agreed to turn over the skull after learning that it was stolen. Cage bought the dinosaur skull in 2007 from a Beverly Hills gallery, outbidding fellow movie star Leonardo DiCaprio for it.
What? What?
Don't you want to own a dinosaur skull?
Yeah, of course.
For $276,000?
Oh, my goodness. Why don't you just go buy a home somewhere else? Why would you buy a dinosaur skull for that much?
Movie stars are weird.
All right, so, that is for sure. So, to be clear, there's no alleged wrongdoing here.
Correct.
But he found that it was stolen and wants to return it to the Mongolian government.
Yes, it belongs to them.
Oh, my. Thank you, Jennifer. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Do you have family coming over for the holidays? Maybe a Christmas Eve dinner or Christmas Day get-together? Maybe even a New Year's Eve toast? Well, what if part of that family includes someone you have unresolved or unspoken issues with? Carrie Herzner, a writer in Cincinnati, discusses grudges, forgiveness, and getting through the holidays with your sanity. She's author of a book called Good Luck, Bill, her own story of family and forgiveness. Carrie, what inspired the book?
Good Luck Bill was inspired by my ex-husband made a statement one day that I had inherited my father's personality, which definitely was not a compliment. I hadn't spoken to my father in 20 years, so for him to say that kind of shook me up. So I set off to find him and discover both, you know, what that meant and who he was. So that's how Good Luck Bill was born.
Oh, my goodness. So what'd you find? Well, since you opened that door, you got to let us in.
Well, I found a very lonely, sad man. And, you know, we spent every Sunday I would go to his house and visit him. And what I had to do is really set my judgment aside and put our past behind us and really just sit down and learn who this man was, who was my father, and go in there without any preconceived kind of thoughts of how the how the reuniting would go.
How did you do that? How did you convince yourself that the past could not be part of current and future discussions?
Well, you know, obviously we talked a lot about the past. I mean, that was all we talked about. But I guess what I mean when I said I had to set it aside, I had to set aside my anger towards him and, you know, just be open to hearing where he came from. It was a really powerful experience, not, you know, going in there just ready to yell at him for all the things he had done my entire life. He was not around. In fact, he disappeared quite abruptly from our lives and would dabble, you know, in and out when it was convenient for him. But we had a very difficult relationship, and I had to set all my feelings and anger towards that aside before I went to see him,
right,
or else it would have been a very short visit.
We're speaking with Carrie Herzner. She's author of a new book called Good Luck, Bill, and we're talking about surviving family during the holidays. Right. That could not have been easy. All right, so sort of connect that to today for others who may be thinking, wow, I got some of that in my life, and it's going to be front and center during some of these holiday dinner meal sit-downs.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that the thought sometimes of seeing a particular person can give you incredible anxiety or make your heart hurt. I think what's important to do and what worked for me was to, you know, before you go into any situation like that, whether it be something as huge as I went into or just knowing you're going to see somebody over the holidays, is kind of stop for a moment. Remember, there are people out there who are going to push your buttons, whether they mean to or not. And before you go into any situation like that, stop for a moment and consider, you know, what is the best version of you? Are you a reactionary person who's going to go in and whatever this person has done or may do during, you know, when you see them or whatnot, are you going to react right away? Or are you able to just step back and remember, you know, you don't have to react to their actions? It takes some time beforehand. I think it's really important before you go into a situation to say, okay, what's the best version? Who am I and how am I going to respond if such and such happens? You know, adults can act like children quite often, and we don't react to children the way they do to us sometimes. So
right.
I think, you know, just kind of keep that in mind. You're not going to let them define you.
It's Carrie Herzner. The book is called Good Luck, Bill. 30 minutes now after the hour.
You appreciate the feeling of a clean, smooth shave from a quality blade. So why are you messing around with generic razors that cost $32 for an 8-pack when you can shave with Harry's high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price? Harry's will give you their starter set, complete with a razor, three of their world-famous blades, and shaving cream for just $15. And shipping is always free. We'll also give you $5 off your first order. So go to harrys.com right now and enter code 7799 at checkout. Code 7799.
Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday, December 23rd. Gordon Deal alongside Jennifer Koschenka. Some of our top stories and headlines. More questions about the San Bernardino terrorists. Amnesty International says Russia has killed hundreds of civilians with airstrikes in Syria. Next Republican debate might only feature 6 candidates. A British Muslim family says U.S. officials blocked them from boarding a plane to Disney. Shoppers at Mall of America today could be blocked by protesters. The NFL releases its Pro Bowl selections and how to button up your finances if you're in your 60s. That story in about 15 minutes. Here's a foreign policy question that's certain to remain unanswered during the rest of the campaign for the White House. Is America better off trying to change unfriendly and dangerous governments or living with and contain them? Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Sibes says this question doesn't merely bedevil the nation's policymakers. It now splits the presidential candidates from both parties, as last week's Republican and Democratic debates showed. Jerry, is there a right or wrong answer?
Well, I don't think there is a clear-cut answer, which is why this is both an interesting debate and an important one in both parties, because, you know, the question is really kind of crystallized around President Assad of Syria, and the question basically is should the U.S. go in, the U.S. wants him gone, should it go in and make that happen, or are you better off, even if you don't like somebody like Assad, containing him, living with him, and not risking the instability that comes with trying to change a country the way we tried to change Iraq by getting rid of Saddam Hussein, or the way Egypt was changed when Hosni Mubarak went away, or the way the West pushed out Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And the argument of the anti-regime change folks is that in every one of those cases, the instability that followed the regime change was worse for everybody in the region, but also worse for the U.S. In its national interests than what was happening before when the thug dictator bad guy was still in power. So that's the debate right now, and I guess the reverse case, which is made by people like Marco Rubio and to some extent Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, is that, you know, at some point you have to, if there's a dictator in place, he's alienating his own people, he's putting a lid on extremism, but if you let that go on for too long, it explodes, and that instability is worse than what you get trying to change the government.
The debate, though, is really made for some strange bedfellows, right? You got odd partnerships within the Republican Party and then crisscrossing with Republicans, Democrats seemingly agreeing on a position.
Yeah, I mean, you have basically a situation here which, on this question of regime change and is it worth it or not, you have Bernie Sanders on the Democratic left and Rand Paul on the Republican libertarian right in agreement, and Ted Cruz to some extent, and Donald Trump to some extent, voicing doubts about whether the U.S. should be going in and doing these kinds of things, and whether the results of the last decade, when we've attempted to push out leaders who were seen as bad for the U.S., whether the results have been worse than the disease they were supposed to cure.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. His piece is entitled Regime Change, Good or Bad? The Question Splits the Parties. I think with a lot of the debates, you know, if you pay a half attention to some of the issues, right, you can pretty much counter what one candidate is saying about a particular issue and know the basic talking points. But when it comes to regime change, I found myself watching that Republican debate. Every time somebody said something, I thought, yeah, that's a good point. And then somebody else would say the opposite. I thought, well, yeah, that's a good point, too.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I think that makes you a typical American, I suppose. I don't think people know what to think here. They want the U.S. to be assertive and to be in charge, if that's the right term, of its own interests around the world. But as President Obama has figured out, they're not really wild about launching into another Iraq-like situation where the change the U.S. wants also comes along with a price tag of having to basically send tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of troops in and be engaged on the ground in a messy effort for a decade to try to clean things up afterwards. And that's the problem. That's a problem for those who don't want to have regime change, and it's a problem for those who do want to have regime change, which is that there's not a really clear, obvious answer, either in terms of what works best or what the American people really want.
Is it possible, then, that the answer to whether or not regime change is beneficial varies country by country?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the situations are all different. You know, for example, if you look at what happened in Egypt, I don't think that was a case in which the U.S. pushed out Hosni Mubarak per se, but it didn't really rise to his defense when he was being threatened. And so, in a sense, the U.S. kind of let regime change happen, and then people have been unhappy with the outcomes, both because in the short term the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, and in the long run a military leader came back in and has been pretty authoritarian. And so lots of people on both sides of the equation have been unhappy with the results.
Thanks, Jerry. Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. It's 20 minutes now before the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Don't forget, if you miss one of our programs, you can hear a podcast of it on our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. Also on apps like TuneIn, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Thanks for being with us, and a good Wednesday to you. After a long career, you might be considering the launch of your own business or to try something new, but are all your ducks in a row? Now that your retirement savings are hopefully larger than they've ever been, you might be more anxious about protecting your nest egg from any moves in the market. Personal finance writer Janelle Marte at the Washington Post has a list of money milestones to hit in your 60s. Janelle, what should we consider?
As you can imagine, each of these series, we always talk about retirement, but now that you, for someone who's in their 60s, it's sort of crunch time when it comes to planning and really putting things into place. You know, this is the time in your life where you have to decide when to take Social Security, and you really need to make some hard decisions in terms of whether you've saved enough. And so a lot of the milestones at this point are around that.
All right. As you mentioned, number one, get real about your retirement income, meaning what?
So this means taking a look at how much you have saved and talking to your financial advisor or using an online tool from your plan provider just to figure out, well, realistically, how much is this going to bring to me in retirement every year? It might be that you can only spend as low as $15,000 or $16,000 out of your savings every year. And then you have to think, well, how else can I supplement that okay, and this is really the time to do it, or make adjustments as to what your expenses are going to be, where you're going to live, you know, the things that are in your control.
Yeah. You also mentioned Social Security, which seems to not be an easy calculation at all as to when to take it or when to delay it.
No, it's not easy, and you have to think you've been paying Social Security taxes for your whole career at this point, and now if it's as early as 62, you can start collecting. And, you know, for some people, that is the best decision, but of course, if you wait till your full retirement age, which is 66 or 67, you get a bigger benefit. And even if you wait until it's 70, it grows 8% every year after your full retirement age up until age 70. And that, it's hard to get that return anywhere else. And for some people, especially if you've had that reality check and you see your savings aren't going to offer you so much, you might want to see if you can wait a little bit more on collecting Social Security.
Mm. We're speaking with Janelle Marte, personal finance writer at the Washington Post. She's got a piece about money milestones to strive for during your 60s. Downsizing of the home, too, something to consider.
Yeah, you want to just figure out where you're going to live and start putting that plan into place. So if you the house is too big, your kids are out of the house, you might want to move to a apartment or a smaller home, and then you have to decide, do I want to buy that smaller home or do I want to rent? You know, it's not as clear cut anymore. So you just, again, do the math. See what's best for your situation. How long do you plan to live in these places? That will all help you figure it out. If you're thinking more ambitious, you want to live abroad, you know, now is the time to get that into place. See what the requirements are in the countries that you're interested in, what the taxes would be like if they'll even have you, because in some places, you really have to show that you have the assets to support yourself. So you want to educate yourself.
All right. You mentioned something here, too, that's important. Resist the urge to dump your stocks.
Oh, yes. So, again, people are thinking that retirement is near and they want to protect what they've had, especially, you know, hopefully you've seen your savings grow, right? So now you have a bigger pot of money that you will also see move up and down more dramatically if there is a big move in the market. So, yes, it's natural. You should become a little bit more conservative and move towards protecting what you have. But don't forget that lifespans are growing, people are living longer, and retirement is longer these days. So you don't necessarily want to sell everything you have and move to cash, and you want to take your time moving to that conservative stance.
All right, so what about on the health insurance front? Because more and more, that's taken up a big chunk of what we've saved.
The biggest thing to be aware of here is people know that after age 65, they have to enroll in Medicare, but they may not realize that a lot of things are not covered fully by Medicare. For instance, home health care or long-term care, you know, needing for anyone who needs to move into an assisted living home. These things are not fully covered by Medicare.
Thanks, Janelle. Personal finance writer Janelle Marte at the Washington Post. 12 minutes now before the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Coming up next, Jennifer Koshenka. We'd love to welcome a new sponsor to the show, All and Sundry, a modern men's shoe company with an old world vision. My friend Nick and his team make the finest handcrafted custom shoes, shoes your grandfather would be proud of. All and Sundry creates a unique experience where you select your style of shoe, whether for work or play. Then you choose the material, add custom features like eye stays, then select a color. They source all the materials and build each one by hand. Without a middleman, you get the savings. No more outrageous markups. If you're a shoe guy, All and Sundry is for you. If you're not, you might change your mind after seeing All and Sundry. Right now, get a 10% discount on a gift card for the holidays. Visit allandsundry.com and enter the promo code DEAL at checkout. That's A-W-L and sundry.com. Then enter DEAL at checkout. All and Sundry, stylish and modern shoes with craftsmanship a grandfather would be proud of. Again, allandsundry.com and enter code DEAL.
Thanks for being with us. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
More than 3,000 prisoners in Washington state may have mistakenly been released early since 2002 because of an error by the state's Department of Corrections. Governor Jay Inslee says he has ordered immediate steps to correct the longstanding problem, calling it maddening. Inslee says a computer program overcredited prisoners with time for good behavior. A recording suggests New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez was inebriated the night officers responded to a noise complaint at a Santa Fe hotel where she was hosting a holiday party. After a hotel clerk called police to report noise and rowdy behavior, the governor called dispatchers to cancel any police response.
There's no necessary no necessity for your office to be here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You can call them off. Goodbye.
The December 13th incident has resulted in a flood of social media posts criticizing the governor for her response to the situation. Many people on the West Coast took to social media last evening to say they'd seen a bright light streaking across the sky. Turns out it was a Russian space debris, a rocket body booster that re-entered the atmosphere. It was spotted by people in California, Arizona, and Nevada. A weather pattern partly linked with El Nino has turned winter upside down across the U.S. during a week of heavy holiday travel, bringing spring-like warmth to the northeast, a risk of tornadoes in the south, and much snow across the west. In a reversal of a typical Christmas, forecasters expect New York to be in the mid-60s on the holiday, several degrees higher than Los Angeles. And that elf on a shelf caused so much anxiety for one child in New Jersey that she called 911 in a panic to report that she accidentally touched it. According to the popular children's book, touching the elf is a no-no and will cause Christmas magic to go away from the home. Police who responded to the 911 call calmed the 7-year-old girl down and got her to agree not to call the emergency number again about the elf. Her mother was home but sleeping when all of this was happening.
Oh, man. Oh. The elf on a shelf for a while caused tremendous panic in my house also. When Kendall was younger,
yeah.
She touched it one time.
Uh-oh.
We had to explain, you know, well, that was not done intentionally. You know, the elves make exceptions. Poor
she
kid.
She didn't call 911.
Called 911. Oh, my goodness. Good job by the police calming her down. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. So ESPN is reporting that the NFL, which spent years criticizing researchers who warned about the dangers of football-related head trauma, has backed out of one of the most ambitious studies yet on the relationship between football and brain disease. The 7-year, $16 million initiative was to be funded out of a $30 million research grant the NFL gave the National Institutes of Health in 2012. The NFL has said repeatedly that it has no control over how that money is spent, but the program Outside the Lines on ESPN says the league balked at this study because the NIH awarded the project to a group led by Dr. Robert Stern, a prominent Boston University researcher who's been critical of the league. Meanwhile, BU yesterday said the NIH would pay for the project, but made no mention of the NFL. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.